Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Power and leadership, two words that are inextricably entwined. We're all leaders at some time in some area of our lives. And to be an effective leader, whether in business, parenting, or any other relational activity in life, one has to know how to use power effectively. But, as is evidenced from events that are daily unfolding on the world stage, learning to share power and lead well in a balanced way is still one of our greatest human challenges. So how can we resolve this? According to tonight's guest, we need look no further for answers than that most magnificent and powerful of animals, the horse. Linda Kohanov is an international speaker, a leadership trainer, and the best-selling author of The Tao of Equus. In her latest book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, she not only offers a new approach to leadership, rooted in the collaborative power of ancient herding cultures and based on her decades of equestrian work, but also shows us how to develop and employ these five roles consciously and fluidly in our modern tribes of families, workplaces, and other social organizations. Linda Kohanov, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Linda, you established your company Upon a Quest Worldwide to explore the healing potential of working with horses, and you offer programs on everything from emotional and social intelligence, leadership, stress reduction, and parenting, to consensus building and mindfulness. And before we discuss your leadership model, and what we can learn from horses as well, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with horses in the first place.
I always loved horses, but my parents were afraid of them, so I wasn't one of those lucky kids who got a horse for Christmas. When I got older, I have a degree in music, and I was making my living as a music critic. I was in radio as well, and people were driving me absolutely insane by the time I reached my 30s. And I was dealing, you know, in the music business with a lot of really big egos. A lot of times we think that, you know, the average person is taught to suppress emotion, but musicians get to express emotion. And what I realized was that suppressing emotion and expressing emotion were two sides of the same profoundly dysfunctional coin, and I just had to get away from people on a regular basis. So I decided to buy a horse. I wanted to ride off into the desert and just get away from everything. And living here outside of Tucson, Arizona, it's very easy to keep a horse. You don't need a big barn. It doesn't get really cold here. And there's just so many beautiful mountain ranges to ride through. The problem is that my horse didn't automatically assume that I was her leader or that I was to be trusted just because I walked around on two legs. This horse, I was used to actually having a lot of people, you know, respect me because they wanted a good music review, or respect me because I was, you know, in some kind of leadership position, whether it was running a radio station or running a major music festival of some kind. And so what was astonishing to me was that when I was out with my horse, I realized that all of my leadership capabilities and the respect that people were affording me was related to my position of influence. Mm-hmm. But that I myself didn't have real leadership qualities outside of that position. And so over time, I began to work with horses, and they began to, like, tune me into a more balanced state, not just in terms of, you know, physically balanced or emotionally balanced, but in terms of being a balanced leader who could be trusted. And it absolutely changed my life.
How long did it take for you to notice this?
Oh, years to notice, to really notice and consciously change those things that the horses were showing me took years to actually put that into practice and then to write about it. I ended up writing 5 books about what horses have to teach people. And I just thought, you know, you could actually have a shortcut to this kind of learning by understanding consciously different lessons that horses are teaching people and creating what I've done now, and I have instructors all over the world actually who teach this method. I realized that you could do safe activities with horses on the ground that would allow people to learn important nonverbal communication skills. Even among humans, only 10% of human communication is verbal. So 90% of the messages we're sending back and forth to each other are in that nonverbal range, and horses are masters at teaching nonverbal communication, and people tend to respect horses because they're so big, and there's something you innately realize that you need to respect when you're working with a horse. So there's a lot of qualities that allow horses to be great teachers. And, you know, some horses love to be teachers and have a gift for it, and other horses would just rather have one owner and just kind of mill around or hang out with their herd. So over the years, too, I've also amassed a herd and helped other people learn how to gain a herd of horses who want to be teachers and who are good at teaching this work to humans who have no horse experience a lot of times.
And, of course, leadership training, you know, for executives has become so popular. And you pretty much pioneered that. I have got several friends in England that are involved in that arena. And I've even had a couple of sessions myself. I mean, horses are absolutely magnificent beings and incredibly intelligent. One only has to look in their eyes to see that. One of the things that intrigues me is how well they interact with kids with autism and how well kids with autism interact with the horses. Would you say it's the same kind of thing that's going on there or something different?
Well, yeah, some horses are naturally, some horses are natural therapists, and they're also really good at sensing when somebody is vulnerable, and their orientation being animals that are not predators. Predators will often use others' vulnerabilities against them for personal gain. That's kind of their purpose. They slink around the edges of herds, and they're always looking for the most vulnerable herd members. They don't really attack adult herd animals in their prime. They often don't win and sometimes even lose in a fatal way. But horses, being non-predatory power animals, they actually tend to sense vulnerability in others and protect the vulnerable. And so when you see a child with autism or a person who's going through who needs some intense help therapeutically, there are many horses who will just reach out to them and really be there for them in a way that a lot of times humans don't even seem to be capable of. But
yeah,
horses are also very, very powerful and sophisticated animals. And so once you've moved beyond needing protection and help, then they up the ante on you. They expect you to get your act together, and they show you how to be balanced. When I was researching my fourth book, The Power of the Herd, I was looking at the history of leadership throughout multiple cultures and across time, and I noticed that a staggering number of our greatest, most innovative leaders were also exceptional equestrians. And so I began to see that the horses were tuning them to a high level of functionality that it's very hard to achieve accidentally. People like George Washington. George Washington was an exceptional equestrian. He was considered one of the best horse trainers in the colonies. And the Buddha was an exceptional horseman. And I truly believe, and I do talk about in The Power of the Herd, that he learned a lot of the skills that he later translated into mindfulness techniques for humans from working with horses, because the same thing happened to me when I was working with horses. So, you know, yes, horses are really good in therapeutic context, but they really are good at teaching high-functioning people how to become balanced and how to truly excel in life.
Yes, I mean, we hear people, you know, who love horses, who own horses, talk about that sense of oneness that develops with their horse. You know, they feel like they're, you know, two halves of a whole. And you don't hear that quite so much about other, you know, animals like dogs and cats and things like that.
Well, I think it, when you're riding, especially, and I don't really do much riding anymore because I'm so fascinated with doing this work with horses and people on the ground. With riding, though, you really have to become one, or you just simply fall off. So if you're going to ride at higher and higher levels, and you're going to stay on your horse, and you're going to develop a relationship that, you know, really allows you to move in harmony with an animal that big and that spirited, it's very natural for people over time to develop a feeling of oneness. If you're going to really ride well, it's almost a requirement.
At what point, you know, in your relationship with your horse, did you realize that you had a whole other career here?
Well, this happened because I had a horse that I was absolutely feeling an amazing sense of oneness with, who had a congenital situation with one of her legs where she actually suddenly couldn't be ridden to any great extent. And her name was Rasa, and I talk about her in my first book, The Tao of Equus. And it was actually me having this close relationship with this horse that I had started from the ground up with a trainer. She was the first horse I learned how to train to be ridden. And it was such an amazing experience, and she and I were connected at such a deep level, and then all of a sudden I couldn't ride her. And so I had to spend a large amount of time with her on the ground and also hanging out with her among herds of horses. And that was the turning point. It was like being knocked off my high horse, so to speak, and being on the ground equal with them, where I really began to understand what they had to teach and what they were capable of, that at the time blew my mind, because a lot of it seemed almost supernatural. Over the years, I've learned how to explain it, and there are even more scientific studies now that will allow me to explain it. But back then, I was like, is this actually happening? Or am I in a Disney movie, or am I dreaming or something? So, yeah, it was actually when I couldn't ride that the whole new world opened up to me, and I wanted to teach this to other people, how I was being transformed. And so I began to develop these ground activities with horses for people who would never ride necessarily.
So tell us how you identified the five disparate roles with unique qualities of leadership that you talk about in the five roles of a master herder.
Well, it happened when I was writing my fourth book, The Power of the Herd, as I mentioned. And I was researching the history of leadership in multiple cultures. And I found that nomadic pastoralists, these are tribes that migrate with large animals, were actually employing what I could see was a socially intelligent form of herd management that involved five roles. And these five roles allow these interspecies communities to move across vast landscapes. So these people have to deal with predators and changing climates. They have to protect and nurture the group while keeping these massive, sometimes aggressive horses and cattle together. And here's the key. They have to do this without the benefit of fences and with very little reliance on restraint. They're moving with huge animals that are not restrained. They have no fences, and they have to keep everyone together. And so it's just really astonishing. So when they have to achieve this kind of a complex goal, the phenomenon of what I began calling the master herder emerges. And I use this term to describe a strong, compassionate, well-balanced leader who's also acting as a caretaker and a guardian. And I noticed that this person had to master five roles of power and social influence and use them fluidly and interchangeably as needed. These roles are the leader, the dominant, the nurturer companion, the sentinel, and they have to separate all four of these roles from the role of predator. And so the fifth role is the predator, but the first four roles, leader, dominant, nurturer companion, and sentinel, must be used without any form of predatory power or intent with these animals, or the animals will run off. So I realized that these rules were also relevant to roles that I could see people using in various leadership and social contexts. But I noticed that very few people in our modern sedentary cultures understood how to use all five of them, and that a really well-balanced, socially intelligent leader has to be able to do that.
Do you think these roles are things that we learn to play as we move through the world, navigate relationships and business, or do you think that they are something that's innate within us?
They're both. This is what makes it a little bit tricky to talk about, but also it gives you some hope, because in general, most people are pretty good at maybe two or three of them already, and they tend to abdicate two or three. But you really need all five to function well. And a lot of the dysfunction that you see in leaders happens because they're overemphasizing certain roles. But some people are naturally attracted to the dominant role. I have horses that are naturally dominant. And they can be very, if they overemphasize that role or they use it in an adolescent form, and you can have an adolescent dominant who's 75 years old. It just means that you're using the role unconsciously, you're overemphasizing it, and you haven't learned how to use that role in a mature way. So adolescent dominance, horse or human, will use intimidation as a form of management. They do this weird thing, and horses do it too. They attack others for little or no reason throughout the day. And they do this to keep everybody a little bit on edge, so that everybody looks away and moves away when they walk into the center of the herd.
I think we're all getting very familiar with that approach from our current president. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest tonight is international speaker, leadership trainer, and best-selling author, Linda Kahanov, and we're talking about her new book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, in which she lays out her revolutionary model for socially intelligent.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, this is Dr. Donice Worden, and I'm excited to tell you about homeopathic injections from Hevert Pharmaceuticals. I utilize them in my practice for pain, inflammation, depression, and other medical conditions. I'm achieving excellent results, and I've seen no adverse reactions. I encourage you to explore these novel treatments.
Call Hevert today at 855-387-6466 to find a practitioner in your area to administer these FDA-registered medications. 855-387-6466.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Linda Kahanov, I would imagine that world events and some of the world leaders that are involved in many of the things that are playing out right now give you great examples to point to.
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump is a great example of someone who overemphasizes the dominant role and uses it in its adolescent form and combines it with the role of predator. And he has almost no access to any of the other roles. So we see like leaders like this. They tend to, you know, autocratic leaders. But what they're really doing is they're overemphasizing one of five roles that they should be learning how to use in a more balanced and thoughtful way. And he's been rewarded for this behavior quite a lot through his life. So no matter what you think of his policies, his behavior is an absolutely stunning example of what I would call a predatory adolescent dominance.
So tell us a little bit about the characteristics, what we will see in, you know, these five roles, how they express themselves.
Well, as I was saying, the dominant role, some people are naturally dominant, as are some horses, and when they're using it in its adolescent form, they can be very intimidating. They have an outrageous sense of entitlement. Here's the thing that you need to know, and I do talk about this in the five roles of a master herder, is that there are some things that you need to know to work with or be the parent of or the spouse of somebody who overemphasizes this role. And one of the things you need to know is that if you yield to a dominant, they will take more liberty. So you have to learn how to set boundaries with these people in a way that doesn't actually cause them to escalate. A lot of times people try to use shame with somebody who's overemphasizing this role, and it doesn't work at all. Don't even bother. When you shame a dominant, they get more aggressive, and we see that with somebody like the current president here in the U.S. People keep trying to shame him into submission, and he just gets more aggressive. It's not actually really good to shame anybody into submission. It's not a good form of behavior control, but people are constantly trying it. Here's the thing, is if you have a naturally dominant child or employee, they may not do such overtly intimidating things to you if they see you as an authority figure, but one of the things they will do is they'll refuse to move when you ask. So they'll often be resistant to things that seem to be in their own best interest, but it is a characteristic of a dominant horse to do all of these things when they're acting in an immature form. And so the dominant horse moves other horses around all day, but nobody moves the dominant horse. And so, you know, you can have a teenager who's naturally dominant and, you know, respects your authority until you try to get him to do something, and that's where the resistance shows up. But the mature use of this role is essential. You need this form of power to break up fights between herd members. A mature dominant horse will break up fights between herd members. They'll keep other herd members out of trouble. They'll herd them away from trouble or danger. They'll motivate or move stubborn or lazy herd members. And they are the most likely to challenge predators. They naturally excel at setting boundaries with aggressors. And if you abdicate the dominant role, because in some cases you've seen it so profoundly misused, you can actually be incredibly ineffective because, you know, that was my choice when I started my organization, ApponaQuest Worldwide, and I didn't understand these five roles. I didn't like this role. I have more of a visionary leader quality and more of a nurturer companion orientation. And so I would just want to lead by example, and I just wanted everybody to get along and sit down and talk about their differences. And so as a result, if I had a couple of team members who were fighting, I wouldn't step in and put a stop to it soon enough and really insist that they, you know, sit down and work it out with some moderation and mutual respect. And that would involve some use of a dominant role. So as a result, people would fight too long. They would say things to each other they couldn't take back. And as a result, factions were created in my organization. And then as a result of that, it got so toxic that I finally had to pick one of these two people and let one of them go. So in essence, by refusing to use the dominant role, I actually had to use the predator role rather than get people back on track and functioning at a higher level. So I often let my staff know or my family know that if I'm using the dominant role with you, it's because I care about you. Because if I didn't, I don't really like to use that role, but if I didn't care about you, I would just let it go on until I decided you had screwed up enough, and I'd let you go. I'd go straight to the predator role. So, you know, you can, I see a lot of times really sensitive, gentle people do that same thing. Let it go and let it go and let it go. And then finally have to, you know, remove someone from the team or a friendship, even end a friendship or something like that.
You also, you know, see in businesses, in families, somebody who is not dominant or doesn't have the dominant role go home and then try to be dominant with, you know, people within their environment just because they need to express that dominance. Now, do you think that's a kind of reaction, trying to reassert authority, or is it just a frustrated, dominant, you know, naturally dominant person?
I think more often it's a naturally dominant person who can't express that at work. They aren't necessarily using it at work. So you see this with women a lot, because a lot of women have been discouraged from developing power or leadership of any kind. I mean, it's getting better now, but a lot of women, and there are naturally dominant women out there for sure, who have been raised to suppress that role rather than learn how to use it properly. And then they've been taught to be nurturer companions and nothing else but that. And so this is, in some sense, the mother we all have to go to counseling for, because you have this naturally dominant woman who's just enacting the role out sideways rather than thoughtfully, and doing that thing. It often shows up where they attack someone for little or no reason. So this is the mother who, you know, you're all dressed up, ready to go to prom, and she says something like, "Oh, I see you got a little few extra pounds there, young lady." Or, "Oh, you're going to wear those shoes?" That kind of stuff, you know. Just those little jabs, those little attacks that dominant individuals will do. And it's an instinctual thing, so with some people and animals. So unless somebody's gotten beyond the instinctual level and learned how to use that role properly in balance with the other roles, it comes out in these highly destructive ways.
Tell us a little bit about the imbalanced and the balanced leader and the sentinel.
Yes, the leader role, here's the interesting thing, is a lot of people mistakenly combine the leader and the dominant role. And this was the interesting thing that I noticed in these herding cultures where I discovered the use of the five roles, is that they actually know for a fact, these herding cultures, that among large herbivores like horses, the leader animal and the dominant animal are often two different animals. And they also perform certain functions that are useful, if it's done well, to the well-being of the entire herd. And so a leader animal among horses is a horse that is attracted to novel situations, whereas the dominant will often herd the other horses away from something new. A leader will sort of move out and move towards the new thing with an appropriate level of caution. But their confidence and curiosity are contagious, and then other animals start to follow them. And so these animals over time add life experience to the mix. And so they're often the ones that know where the best food and water is. And they're the ones that look at something new and determine if it's useful or not. And so these would be like the horse innovators. And so, you know, a leader among people tends to have those qualities too. They're attracted to new things. And among humans, they also exhibit exceptional visionary qualities. They tend to calm and focus others during tense or novel situations, whereas the naturally dominant individual will stir up fear to gain control. And a natural leader tends to motivate through inspiration. They're kind of drawing you forward and inspiring you, where a dominant has a pushing, directing, and protecting energy, and they can push through resistance. But if you overemphasize the leader role, you'll find that these people can lose touch with others, and they can appear aloof or self-absorbed. It's like they sometimes get so far out in front of others that no one else can really follow them, and they can seem unsympathetic or easily frustrated by interpersonal drama. And, you know, so it's this feeling of you know, okay, I started this nonprofit to feed all of the homeless in Milwaukee, and you guys are back there with some kind of interpersonal issue fighting. We're supposed to be feeding the homeless. Why are you wasting our time with that? Why can't you get your act together and get back on track? So this would be a leader without any nurture or companion skills, someone who couldn't come back around and say, okay, what's going on here? What do we need to do to move forward? Does somebody need some additional training? You know, and if a leader like this is lacking in the use of the dominant role, they're terrible at delegating tasks, and they're terrible at pushing people through resistance when necessary. And so they can end up taking on too much responsibility, because the one thing they'll end up saying is, it's just easier to do it myself. Have you ever met somebody like that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, I think we all have.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's someone who's overemphasizing the leader role without use of the nurture companion or dominant roles in particular in that example.
I can see where, you know, beyond the corporation and the corporate arena, I can see how this could be invaluable knowledge in relationships of any kind. I mean, parenting, male-female, partner relationships, love, whatever, having this kind of knowledge and the skills and learning to balance these parts of ourselves, indeed even knowing, you know, where our, preferences lie. Tell us how we can find them out.
Well, I do have an assessment, a professional assessment. I have one for personal relationships that I'm still tweaking a little bit. But in the book itself, there's a professional assessment you can take, which will show you which roles you're balancing and maybe which roles you're overemphasizing and which roles you may be completely ignoring or abdicating. And so if you overemphasize any of the roles, you will have some dysfunctions that occur. And if you're fairly well balanced in the roles, you're going to be more effective at choosing the appropriate role for the situation. If you abdicate a role, you can be highly dysfunctional as well. So it's just a way, it's also a way of looking at people and not rejecting who they are, but just seeing them as overbalancing a role. So if you have a more aggressive, intimidating, naturally dominant person in your family or on your team, you can just look at them as, oh, they're overemphasizing this role and using it in an immature form. That's not who they are. They're not. We don't have to diagnose them with a mental health disorder. We can actually help them become more balanced. You know, or if somebody overemphasizes the nurture companion role, they will engage in all kinds of passive-aggressive forms of manipulation. And they can do some really nasty things behind the scenes. They tend to use gossip as a bonding tool when they don't feel like they're heard. And so they can be very toxic to a family. But it's not who they are. They're not evil. They don't need to be diagnosed. They're just overemphasizing a role. And once they learn how to use the other roles, they'll be fine.
Yes, and if you have this kind of knowledge, I mean, in a family, for example, you can really learn that dance that's required, that, you know, everybody gets empowered rather than, everybody's worst sides come to the fore, particularly when there's, disagreements going on.
Yes, I have a lot of family systems therapists that go through my instructor training program. And they end up using this with families, teaching families how to become more balanced. It's a marvelous model, and I even have a little extra handbook for that I use in training that was developed by Dr. Rebecca Bailey and I. She is a psychologist who works with people who are victims of violence, extreme violence. And she also works with people who are going through really toxic, terrifying divorce situations. And so she works with extreme family situations, and she's found this model very useful in helping people to move forward in a more productive way.
We all, encounter difficult people in our lives. If we did not know, where our preferences are, what we're weak in, what we're strong in, is there something that you could Could we still learn how to diffuse a situation that was about to, you know, explode without that knowledge?
Well, I think once you have this knowledge of the five rules, a lot of dysfunction in human groups suddenly makes sense. You know, it doesn't seem like just crazy, irrational behavior anymore. So you've got this person over here, you know, who's overemphasizing the nurturer companion role and so is engaging in passive aggressive moves to gain some kind of influence or feel like they need to be heard. And then over here, you have this, you know, 71-year-old adolescent dominant, you know, attacking others for little or no reason and pushing people and taking advantage of the ones who actually yield to them. And then you have a leader who's over here who has this great vision, but they seem kind of disconnected and far ahead and kind of aloof, and you're not sure if they really care about you or not. And then, you know, you have this person over here who's emphasizing the predator role, and so they're kind of slinking around the edges looking for your vulnerability to use against you for your personal gain. You know, so when you see that kind of behavior in a group, you're just all of a sudden, and I've had many people say this to me who've studied this work and read the book, is that first of all, it just allows you to make sense of human behavior in groups with a feeling of a hopefulness that there is something that can be done about this.
Yes. Yeah. One of the challenges I think that many people face and a cause of great dissatisfaction is people feeling disempowered. Now, power, you know, I mentioned that word at the beginning. It is a quite a loaded topic, and we've heard a great deal. It's been dominating the headlines of late for several months, you know, sexually threatening, predatory power wielded by Hollywood influences, you know, the big bucks buying power, billionaires, and even the power games that we all play to get what we want in life. When we come back from the break, I'd really like to look at power a little bit more and why it's such a difficult topic to discuss in our culture. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and tonight I'm speaking with international speaker, leadership trainer, and best-selling author Linda Kahanov about her new book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder. We'll be back with more after this break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, this is Dr. Donice Worden, and I'm excited to tell you about homeopathic injections from Hevert Pharmaceuticals. I utilize them in my practice for pain, inflammation, depression, and other medical conditions. I'm achieving excellent results, and I've seen no adverse reactions. I encourage you to explore these novel treatments.
Call Hevert today at 855-387-6466. To find a practitioner in your area to administer these FDA-registered medications. 855-387-6466.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Linda Kahanov, why is power such a difficult topic to discuss in our culture?
I think it's because, on one hand, it's so profoundly misused, and people who are more compassionate and really want to take care of others and have a culture where everybody can share in prosperity and we can solve our problems together. I think a lot of people with that orientation actually avoid or abdicate power or say they're not interested in it because they've seen it misused. And sometimes people have trouble with power because they've been victimized by people with, you know, as we were saying, with the Me Too movement, this feeling of a power differential or somebody being powerful over you, trying to take advantage of you. And so power ultimately is simply a form of influence. It is the ability to stand up and to be heard, to be able to offer your ideas, and then also to put a line in the sand to protect others. And so everybody needs power, but we're so dysfunctional about even whether we're interested in it or not that we're not learning how to use it. I mean, how many years do we learn, go to school and learn how to read and write and run a computer, and yet who really teaches us how to use power properly? Is there even a science to that necessarily? I spent years researching this because I needed to know about it myself. I mean, we're at the point now where we need sensitive, caring, compassionate people to become empowered and know how to stand up to those who are using power carelessly. We need to be able to stand up to these people without shaming them or hurting them or isolating them. And there are definitely ways to use power appropriately, to use power in such a way that you can gain the confidence and trust of not just fearful people and horses, but of the more aggressive people and horses that I've encountered. I had a stallion. I learned about power because I had a stallion who had been severely abused, and he was enraged, and he would attack you for no reason at all. And in order to help that horse, I found that kindness and sympathy and understanding weren't enough to begin to heal the wounds of that level of dysfunction, and that I had to become powerful myself, but in a way that was not abusive. And that was the turning point for me, of becoming interested in this subject. Had I not been powerful enough to handle this horse named Merlin, he would have been destroyed. And I guess it took me... it took that level of motivation for me to become interested in power. But power can also be seen, if it's used well, the same way that we look at power that's plugged into a wall. You know, you can use it to turn up a lamp or turn down a lamp or turn on a stove. You know, but it has to be properly channeled and controlled. And then it's just a utility. But at the same time, stick your finger, you know, in the socket and you get a big shock and... You know, so this work is really about learning how to use power in the same way that we use electricity, in a properly channeled, functional way.
Yeah, and to understand about power. I mean, many people have so many misconceptions. It's okay to be empowered, but it's not okay for some people to feel that they are powerful. It's frightening. And many people think, you know, that collaboration means giving up power, our authority lies in our power. So you're absolutely right. We really do need to get some balance here. How do we change these old patterns? I mean, you talk about non-predatory power in the book. How can we learn to use this in our daily lives?
That was the key turning point for me. When I was working with horses, they are very powerful animals, but people would talk about them as prey animals and human beings as predators. Human beings are predators and horses are prey animals, and a lot of the dysfunction in those relationships happens as a result of that. That's what you'll hear from a lot of high-level trainers, horse trainers. But as it turns out, humans are omnivores. We have characteristics of predatory and non-predatory animals. We have the teeth of a vegetarian, but our eyes are forward, like lions. And we've grown up in these highly predatory, conquest-oriented cultures where predatory power and attitudes are rewarded in business and in politics and in other places like that. But for me to realize that horses, first of all, weren't quivering, gutless victims. So it was, after a while, it was impossible for me to call a horse a prey animal. A horse is an herbivore, for sure, but they are not victims. They will stand up and especially stand together. So that's why I called my last book, The Power of the Herd. They will stand together and they will protect vulnerable herd members. They'll even perform altruistic acts to save vulnerable herd members who are being attacked by predators. And sometimes they're actually quite successful. But they employ a non-predatory form of power. And one of the primary characteristics of that is that they will stand up to predators. But when the predator runs off, they just go back to grazing. They don't chase the predator down and murder them in an act of revenge, you know. So when you hear a lot of metaphors for excelling in our culture, we're using predatory metaphors. You really killed the competition there. You really crushed that, you know. Instead of, you know, the horse is like, we did this together. We are safe together. And a movement like the Me Too movement is such a great example of non-predatory power of the herd standing together. And that is very powerful. We can stand up to predators when we stand together. And so being powerful together and collaborating is also an aspect of non-predatory power. And I'll tell you, you know, I've had some people, I've worked with some people who have been raped, some people who have been kidnapped, and suffered extreme violence. And one of the things that makes a difference for them is that when they come back out of sometimes years of therapy to get to the point where they are ready to really step forward in their life, they will often try to turn down power because they've seen it so profoundly misused on them. But when they hear that the horse is a non-predatory power animal and that the horse protects others and horses stand together, and those are aspects of non-predatory power, they get inspired and they begin to become empowered and learn how to protect their own children and to stand up for the rights of victims. So the horse as a non-predatory power animal is an incredible inspiration.
I think that there is it's a wonderful phrase, non-predatory power, and I'd like to see it become as popular as, you know, empowered. It seems to be have so much more substance to it. It has so much more balance within it, I feel. And this is something that I think right now, at this time in our history, we really need more of this. Have you ever been asked to, you know, take some of your programs into government?
Well, I would love to. I think it could be very useful. I've had individuals who are, you know, running for office come and study with me, and you know, they found it very useful because, you know, when if you're going to run for some kind of political office, you've got to be strong and heroic to handle the kinds of attacks that come at you from the other side on a daily basis. But you have to do it in such a way that you're creating a feeling of these people can learn to trust you and share differences in a mutually respectful way. So when you have people attacking you from the other side and you're trying to function in politics and you attack back every time you get attacked, this is incredibly unproductive. Mm-hmm. And we just see this kind of behavior going on all the time. And people are like, what happened to our ability to have mutually respectful discussions when we disagree or when we're exploring ideas, you know? Yes. And it really takes people who feel empowered and secure and confident in themselves while not misusing power to push the other down. So these skills are essential in government and essential in democracy. I mean, I really believe that part of the reason our democracy is in a state of limbo is because we have two political parties in the United States, both of which tend to overemphasize different roles. So the Democrats tend to overemphasize the nurturer companion role and the leader, the visionary leader role. And the Republican Party tends to overemphasize the dominant role and the predator role. And neither party is sometimes very good at using the sentinel role. And the sentinel role is often associated with the press, if it's running properly, which is to step back from the group and watch the group in relation to threats and opportunities in the environment. And so a lot of times politicians aren't engaging the sentinel role because they're so interested in forwarding their agenda. They're not they're not listening well enough to the rest of the culture, and they're not looking at threats and opportunities in the environment. They're so focused on making their case for their vision.
So in that situation,
we have limbo because neither side can function at a high enough level.
Exactly. We see this daily, you know, when one watches Britain's Parliament. I mean, it becomes so childish. One wonders how one elected these people in the first place. You know, these are supposed to be the leaders and the lawmakers. I really do think it would be wonderful if you could get into Parliament and you could get into the White House and you know, teach people what you know. I know that you've used your revolutionary model with executive teams at such companies as Nike and Chubb Insurance and Raytheon. Beyond what you, you know, the brief bit you gave us earlier, what do you typically witness when you work with executive teams at large companies like this?
Well, what I've seen is that when I can show the five roles of a master herder, when people can really understand both the high functioning version of that role and the dysfunctions that occur when people overemphasize it, they really light up and they start looking at each other and whispering about certain people that now they feel like they understand, and they can actually begin to fathom moving forward, not seeing as people they're having difficulties with as being a problem. But as overemphasizing a role, and that all of a sudden makes you take things much less personally. A lot of times with executives, I see people really light up when I talk about the immature dominance behaviors, and I'm like, you never have to take this personally again. This is not personal. This person who attacks you one day for little or no reason—that's a characteristic of that role. Horses do the same thing. You never have to stay up all night again and take that behavior personally. So it makes a huge difference. Just when I do indoor half-day workshops on what the five roles are and the functional and dysfunctional aspects of each.
Yeah, it removes the defensive aspect that we all tend to, go into when confronted with things like this, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. And if you aren't taking the behavior personally anymore, all of a sudden you don't get so triggered, you don't get so aggressive yourself. And there's also, you know, some hints for, you know, in the book, and then also particularly when you're working with horses, where you actually practice constructive ways of handling the dysfunctions coming from others that really turn a situation around. And a lot of the things that you need to be doing are nonverbal. And so the horses help you learn those tools. And I've had people go back and say, wow, all of a sudden, you know, I've been able to turn around some difficulties in my company just having practiced how to stand up to certain kinds of horses and then translate that into some conversational tools that we give people.
Now, you offer programs on everything from emotional and social intelligence, as I said earlier, leadership, stress reduction, and parenting, etc. What's your favorite ones?
I love to do workshops with the power of the herd and the master herder principles. People just really end up making such headway in their personal lives and their professional lives when they can come out and work with the horses at this level. I also have a new program on a series of tools that I call sentient communication. And it's really about helping people learn a kind of grammar or vocabulary for nonverbal communication. You know how we break down verbal communication when we're learning sentence structure and all that, and then mm-hmm. by learning verbal grammar, we become better writers and better communicators. And so you can actually learn the grammar of nonverbal communication through and learn how to use breathing and change your heart rate and how to affect others through certain kinds of breathing and body posture and learning to use emotions as information in others and how you can use that information without even bringing up the emotion, just using that information to help have course-correcting conversations. These are sentient communication skills so that people learn how to consciously process and respond to, rather than unconsciously react to, nonverbal information coming from themselves and others. And you can actually learn how to elevate instinctual impulses and physiological processes into a mindful language.
Linda Kernoff, we're out of time now, I'm afraid. I think your book, having read it, is very timely, much needed, and a great service to us all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Way of the Horse, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership with Linda Kohanoff, or by Linda Kohanoff, is published by New World Library. For more information, go to EponaQuest, EponaQuest.com, and MasterHerder.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.